This is Dr. Guy.
And this is Dr. John.
Two brothers from other mothers. Welcome to Diseases, Death, and Doctors. If it is your first time, we'd like to welcome you to the pod, a storytelling podcast that discusses the non-chronological history of medicine, because it's easier that way. And who doesn't want their doctors cutting corners? I went a little faster this week, Dr. John.
Yeah, you crushed it this week. Also, the echo is gone from last week.
Well, that's good. Well, now your audio is going to be the one that's impaired since you're vacationing it up.
Since I'm phoning it in from Margaritaville.
You got your jorts on. You're enjoying Florida to its utmost.
Yeah, I'm still looking for my glory. Lost shaker of salt.
Well, listeners, today we're going to discuss my fifth favorite Summer Olympic sport, polio.
Heyo. Do you like water polio or regular polio?
Well, seeing that I was reared in Kentucky, I like the horsey polio the most. But when I referred to my fifth favorite Olympic sport, I was referring to water polio. Those sexy little helmets that people wear as they bob up and down in the pool.
Is horsey polio in the Olympics?
I don't think so.
Did you know we're about to have another Olympics right now?
In China?
Yeah, we just had one in Japan like 6 months ago.
That's because they delayed it. Everything's on a weird curve. We just had, in fact, I think they just had like the 2020 European Championships in soccer, even though they occurred in 2021, because COVID, of course, has interfered with all our entertainment. All right. Polio.
Marco.
So poliomyelitis is an acute viral infection caused by a member of the genus enterovirus known as the poliovirus. Surprise! And although major polio epidemics were unknown before the latter part of the 19th and the 20th century, the disease has caused paralysis and death for much of human history. Today, it's a delightful, rare, but highly contagious microorganism that is spread from person to person through the fecal-oral route. That's right, listeners, from infected fecal matter entering your mouth. And Dr. John, I'd like to say this is the primary reason I've never participated in a human centipede.
Well, you also haven't been invited, but...
That's true. I don't have any friends. At least no adventurous friends. So it's spread most commonly via contaminated food and water and rarely through infected saliva. And this is also why Dr. John gave up ATM, I believe. Once the virus gains access to the mouth, it infects the first cells it comes into contact with. And those cells would be within the pharynx and the intestinal mucosa. And once the virus gains access to the cell, it hijacks the host cell's own machinery and begins to replicate itself excessively. Replication eventually leads to the virus progeny entering the bloodstream, resulting in viremia, enabling the virus to be widely distributed throughout the body and resulting in its more mild flu-like symptoms. Now, however, should the virus spontaneously move from the gut to the central nervous system, and this is only seen in less than 1% of cases, it then attacks the ventral horn cells of the spinal cord. This is bad. As well as motor neurons of the brainstem and motor cortex, catastrophic symptoms may follow. Permanently atrophic musculature, underdeveloped extremities, spinal curvature, facial nerve paralysis, and additional more extensive paralysis can occur. The inflammation and destruction of neural cells leads to paralytic poliomyelitis. Children are less likely than adults to acquire paralytic polio, as it presents in 1 in every 1,000 cases. In adults, the frequency is greater, with paralysis occurring in 1 in every 75 adults that are infected. Researchers haven't identified really any appreciated viral benefit associated with its CNS invasion. So it doesn't improve its fitness in any manner. It appears to be a chance occurrence that when it happens, the results can be potentially devastating.
I would have thought it was the opposite. I thought it was more devastating to the neurologic system in kids
children
and adults. Yeah,
I thought the same thing, because I feel like every picture I've ever looked at that discusses polio or any article describing it, it always shows a child.
Yeah.
Which maybe that's just to kind of stir at my heartstrings a little bit, but I don't know.
It's for the children. Oh man. Well, that is, that's super interesting. So it just seems to be just a random thing. Not dissimilar to COVID, but just wreaks havoc in some people in their pulmonary system. This does it in the neurologic system, the ventral horns of the spinal cord.
Right.
I remember those.
Little butterfly. Once upon a time. Yeah, we're looking at a few cross sections of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't it always drive you crazy how the neuroanatomy was flipped from the regular anatomy when you're looking at the slides? Because like you're looking at an MR or something like that, or an X-ray, and it's always right is left and left, is right. Mm-hmm. But when you're looking at neuroanatomy, it's right is right,
right
and left is left.
Yes.
That always drove me crazy.
Which I guess is because you're looking down. Yeah, no, I agree. Like, it's something that you've got to wrap your head around and know going into it. Otherwise, it's just like a complete mind rape.
Yeah, I remember the little butterfly of the white matter or dark matter. I forget what it looks like.
Yeah, tell us more.
Yeah, no, that's a little butterfly.
I love when Dr. John makes himself sound smart. Makes up for my incompetence. People forget about my inability to pronunciate anything that we've discussed.
How much Greek and Latin do we have in this episode?
I have, once again, I failed to proofread this. Spoke with my father before the episode, and that conversation went a bit long. So well, there's going to be some surprises on page 3, 4, 5, and 6. We'll see. Choose your own adventure. Fun fact, you know Mitch McConnell had polio when he was younger?
Is that why it looks like such a turtle? Did it affect his jaw or his neck?
I cannot comment on that, but that is why he was like one of the lone GOP individuals that was supporting vaccination. He's a firm believer in the effect of the vaccine. But another story for another day. So this symptomatic development can occur over a few hours to a few days. The weakness most often involves the legs, but may less commonly involve the muscles of the head, neck, and diaphragm. Now, it is the involvement of the respiratory function, the diaphragm, and the bulbar muscles, or muscles within the mouth and throat, that are responsible for swallowing and speech, that make poliovirus potentially fatal. Now, fortunately, many people fully recover, but of those who develop muscle weakness, about 2-5% of children and 15-30% of adults die. For the most part, up to 70% of those infected have no symptoms, while another 25% of infected persons have minor symptoms such as fever and sore throat, and up to 5% have headache, neck stiffness, and pains in the arms and the legs that are usually back to normal within 1 or 2 weeks. Only supportive treatment is available for poliomyelitis, but some recovery occurs in the majority of patients who survive the acute stage of the illness. And if you hear any weird scratching in the background, our pug is feasting. She's emerged from her sleep to eat her dinner. Sounds like there's a raccoon rooting through our trash, but it's actually an animal we invited into our household. So.
Does it have some paralysis of the pharynx?
No. Although some pugs do. Say hi, Sadie. All right. So of note, curiously, years after recovery, some patients experience a phenomenon known as post-polio syndrome. And that's associated with the slow development of muscle weakness similar to that which the person had during the initial infection. It's like one of those, like, acid trips that comes back like years later.
Have you heard the Norm MacDonald stand up about that?
No. Like, God rest his soul.
Yeah. It's like, if I was a drug dealer, that's how I'd advertise it. 2 for 1.
Oh, Norm. As I said earlier, major polio epidemics were unknown before the latter part of the 19th and into the 20th century. But according to historians, the disease was both present and participating in human prehistory. What exactly is prehistory, you ask? Well, it is a ridiculous term in my professional opinion, but it simply means the period of time prior to written records. Prehistory. Like you could
I never knew you had such strong opinions about the term prehistory. How are we just getting to this in our relationship?
It could be like pre-medicine before 1920.
Yeah. If history is what we know from writing, pre-written word makes sense. But hey, who am I?
Evidence of its viral shenanigans were identified, carved, painted onto a well-known Egyptian stele, a.k.a. a standing stone slab used in the ancient world primarily as a grave marker, but also for dedication, commemoration, and demarcation, the DCDs. Dating back to the 18th Egyptian dynasty, between 1570 and 1342 BCE, the stele clearly depicts a priest with a telltale paralysis and withering of his lower right leg and foot. I guess we are forced to assume that polio is the only thing that could potentially cause this. Oh, that has polio.
I take issue with some of the times that they interpret that. The stele clearly depicts a priest with a telltale paralysis. That's the only thing it could be.
Three-fourths of the stele are chipped off.
Yeah. Like, it's just worn down, and they're, like, using, like, a piece of paper and charcoal tracing on it. And they're like, well, this is all that it could be.
Our foremost medical historian believes this is obviously polio. Anyway, in addition, the mummy of Pharaoh Sipta from the late 19th dynasty, 1342, to 1197 BCE also shows similarly characteristic deformities of the left leg and foot.
Maybe that was just a cool way to draw people. Give them a little stanky leg.
I know.
That's still a thing.
That's a sign of respect.
I don't think people are still doing the stanky leg.
It is presumed, however, that the absence of additional findings until as recently as the 18th century are the result of the relative sporadic appearance of the infection. So sporadic, we went from 1570 to 1342 BCE to the 18th century. That is a prolonged duration.
I always have a hard time doing that math. You got to go down and then up one. Okay.
Now, remember, only a small percentage of infected individuals would ever physically be scarred due to paralytic polio. So perhaps many people just had asymptomatic illness and it went unnoticed if they didn't have their stinky leg.
Maybe it mutated.
Could have.
Maybe the neuro whatever was the newer thing.
I think people probably just...
Dr. Guy, you ever think about that?
I think it's more likely that people just probably started washing their hands. I mean, isn't that like in the Bible when Pontius Pilate washes his hands before? So somebody was doing it.
Dinner?
No. Like before they.
Yeah. When
before Pontius they convicted
Pilate and
Jesus.
Jesus were at dinner together, they washed their hands.
I know. He's like, I wash my hands of this. So obviously, somebody is. Somebody was washing their hands.
Yeah, and then they all had dinner and it was great. And it was a weekly occurrence and it was not the Last Supper at all. It was the first.
Small micro digression. It is an irony of medical history that the transformation of polio into an epidemic disease occurred only in those industrialized countries in North America and Europe that had experienced significant improvements in hygiene during the 19th and 20th centuries. That has led health experts to conjecture that the infection was common in earlier times, but that people were exposed and infected in typically unhygienic environments at very young ages when they were less likely to suffer permanent paralysis, aka adulthood, as an outcome. So as hygiene improved, the certainty of young people of successive generations being exposed to the virus was gradually reduced. And ultimately, there was a gradual loss of natural immunity. Hence, when the virus was suddenly reintroduced, there was an ample population of virus-naive persons, children and adults ripe for infection, and driving a new era of polio epidemics. So that makes sense. I mean, that could explain maybe back in Egypt, that's when it first was noticed and materialized, and then all of a sudden the pandemic worked its way out because people were infected, became naturally immune to it, and then along came civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Ish.
I mean, well, it sounds like just like the earlier you can get infected,
the better off you are.
Better, yeah.
Because it's like less likely to have a devastating impact on you.
Yeah, all right. Interesting.
Indeed. So the first epidemics appeared in the form of outbreaks of at least 14 cases near Oslo, Norway in 1868, and then 13 cases in northern Sweden in 1881. About the same time, the idea began to be suggested that the sporadic cases of infantile paralysis might be contagious. It would be a minute before that would be confirmed, of course. The next significant epidemic, 10 times larger than the previous outbreaks, and the first major documented polio outbreak in the United States occurred in Rutland County, Vermont. I mean, I think it was probably just a tick bite. 18 deaths, 132 cases of permanent paralysis were reported. And Charles Caverly, MD, noted the appearance of acute nervous system disease in the county. He was one of the first physicians to recognize that polio could occur with or without paralysis. He did not assume, however, that the disease could be spread from person to person. A newspaper article from the time described the diversity of opinions in the local physician community regarding the potential for a contagious source. Many doctors believed that it was impossible for, quote-unquote, meningitis, the initial diagnosis reported, to be contagious. However, other doctors held the belief that cerebrospinous meningitis was highly contagious. The newspaper highlighted the fact that many of the county doctors were contacting the state medical board for assistance, demonstrating that the disease wasn't too well known in the medical world. Today, we understand that the source of their quote-unquote, meningitis was, in fact, polio. And the virus was contagious. However, this would not be universally established until 1905. And so to read some excerpts, this is the newspaper article that kind of charts this, and I'm not going to read it all because you'll get the point quickly. The excerpt from the newspaper article goes as such, and this is from 1894. Fatal cases. 18 deaths occurred as follows. 1. Boy, 10 years. Died within 24 hours with convulsions. 2. Boy, 6 years. Died on the 6th day with convulsions. 3. Boy, 10 months. Died on the 6th day, paralyzed in both legs. 4. Boy, 4 months. Died on the 6th day, all of the extremities paralyzed. 5. Girl, 11 years. Died on the 3rd day, no paralysis noted. And on it goes.
Like 1, 2, 3, and 4, they all had neurologic stuff. 5.
Didn't.
Number 5, girl, 11 years, died on 3rd day. 3rd day of what?
That's kind of funny. Actually, I could read more. I don't know, 3rd day of symptoms of her mild symptoms. But actually, if you read the next 2, there's a girl, 1.5 years, died on the 6th day, no paralysis. Female, 21 years, died on the 13th day, no fixed paralysis. Male, 19 years, died on the 5th day, both legs paralyzed. Sex and age not started, had paraplegia.
Sounds like all the boys.
I'm trying to find. If you go down to death number 13, girl, 7-year-old, died on the 7th day, all extremities paralyzed. For a while, I was looking, this is not looking too good for those XY chromosomes out there.
Yeah, I'm just saying, maybe a few of these girls, they just swept in with the other 18 and said, we're going to chalk this up to polio.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying people are doing that with COVID, but they're kind of doing it with COVID.
And also, what's up with these bros thinking that it wasn't contagious or infectious? They thought everything was contagious and infectious back then, ish. I mean, you know, they had the germ theory.
Miasma.
Yeah. Like, it was either witches or some type of bad air. I think the only non-infectious thing that we've talked about so far is scurvy, right?
Yeah, basically. during an epidemic of 1,031 cases in Sweden in 1905, the Nordic folks are really getting hammered by this, by the way, it seems like.
They're so clean.
Huh?
They're so cleanly.
I know. So cold. Ivor Wickman first recognized that patients with non-paralytic disease could still spread the virus. Ding, ding, Ivor.
Ivor's right.
Then in a subsequent epidemic of 3,840 cases in 1911, Carl King and colleagues in Stockholm recovered the virus from healthy carriers as well as paralytic patients. In studying several fatal cases from the same outbreak, Kling found the virus in the victims' throats and also in tissues of their small intestines. During the second decade of the 20th century, it became apparent that far more people were being rendered immune to polio by previous asymptomatic infections than were being immunized by recovery from overt disease. By then, polio was well on the way to becoming a widely feared periodic phenomenon. In the 1940s and early 1950s, Western Europe and North America lived through summertime terrors that were brought about by nearly annual polio epidemics. One of the problems was the fact that no one understood how you got it. A national poll, this is a quote, found that polio was second only to the atomic bomb as the thing that Americans feared the most in the 1950s.
Yeah, that'd be terrifying. Just some random virus comes out and paralyzes you. Like one out of 75 adults and one of 1,000 kids.
Jeez. Yeah, not cool. At its peak incidence in the United States in 1952, approximately 21,000 cases of paralytic polio, a rate of 13.6 cases per 100,000 population, were recorded. As outbreaks were concentrated in the summer and early autumn, children were kept away from swimming pools, movie theaters, and other crowded places where they might be exposed to the dreaded virus. Many survivors had to wear painful metal braces on their paralyzed legs to prevent collapse and were forced to rely on assistance with ambulation. Now, one bogus approach was to spray acid into the noses of children to block the virus. That doesn't sound smart. All it did was ruin the sense of smell.
Maybe they had COVID.
Outbreaks were widely reported in the press, and polio victims encased in iron lungs were often displayed in public places such as department stores in order to encourage donations to efforts on research and to combat the disease.
God, that's morbid.
Yeah. So have you ever seen an iron lung, by the way?
I see what you're going to reference, and that's the only one that I've seen.
I know, that's the only thing. The Big Lebowski is the only, my only. Yeah. But yeah, so for our younger viewers that are unfamiliar with the cinematic glory of The Big Lebowski, or The Iron Lung for that matter, it's basically a giant metal coffin, like a cabinet respirator, that was considered state-of-the-art life support tech in the early 20th centuries. Or a century, and doctors and scientists struggled to keep patients alive once they contracted paralytic polio, affecting their diaphragm and because they can no longer breathe. And so a team from Harvard University, including Philip Drinker and Louis Agassiz Shaw, and I don't even know why I put their names in here, just so I could brutally pronunciate them, when I could have just simply ignored who created it and moved on with my life. But anyway, they developed the iron lung in order to keep these patients breathing. It consisted of a huge metal box with a set of bellows attached at one end that was used to pump air in and then out. The whole body was enclosed in an airtight chamber apart from the head. So you could still give little kisses. A tight rubber seal supported the neck and ensured that air did not escape. And the iron lung was first used to treat a patient in 1928 when it was used to save the life of an 8-year-old girl with polio at Boston Children's Hospital.
So it was basically negative pressure ventilation instead of positive pressure ventilation. I mean, because now you end up with a trach and a
breathing tube,
and we're pushing air in. But this was just entire body negative pressure that expanded the lung somehow. I need to look up on how an iron lung actually worked.
It's all about the bellows.
That's crazy. That's fascinating.
Although with that said, I do want to go back to the fact that they displayed the patients in the iron lungs in public places and department stores. Because in my opinion, this strategy rocks. I mean, I think we totally need to utilize this today. I mean, if you don't want a COVID vaccine, well, try to enjoy your shopping trip with three people prone on a ventilator in the swimsuit section in Nordstrom.
We're running out of ICU space. Let's convert the
department stores.
Half of the men's department to step-down units, little LTACs.
So in such an environment, it is not surprising that the announcement of an effective vaccine in 1955 was hailed as a mid-20th century miracle.
Don't tell me what to do, government.
The poliovirus itself was discovered in 1908 by a team led by Viennese immunologist and future Nobel Prize winner Karl Landsteiner. The next Viennese, is that how you say that for Vienna? Viennese immunologist.
Yeah.
Anyway, the next step in medical community's understanding of this terrifying disease was the identification of the existence of telltale antibodies specific to the virus circulating in the blood of infected persons, only 2 years after Landsteiner's discovery. In 1931, two Australian researchers, Frank McFarlane Burnett and Jean McNamara, using immunologic techniques, were able to identify the different serotypes of the poliovirus. Burnett was to receive a Nobel Prize in 1960, but surprise, surprise, the woman who is Jean McNamara was somehow left off of history's medal podium. Boo. In 1948, the team of John Enders, Thomas Weller, and Frederick Robbins, working at Harvard Medical School in Massachusetts, showed how the virus could be grown in large amounts in tissue culture, in advance for which they shared a Nobel Prize in 1954. And from there, it was only a short step to an announcement in 1953 by Jonas Salk at the University of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that he had developed an effective killed virus vaccine.
What was the episode that you were talking about? That if you do anything with tuberculosis, you get tuberculosis. A Nobel Prize?
No, it wasn't TV. Was it malaria? Boom. That's it.
Maybe it was malaria. Yeah. Anything
malaria,
with malaria.
Polio.
And apparently polio, too.
If you cure cancer, you'll probably get one. Stalk's vaccine, known as the inactivated poliovirus vaccine, aka IPV, was put to a massive nationwide test in 1954-55. Called the Francis Field Trial after Thomas Francis Jr., University of Michigan professor who directed it. The test involved 1.8 million children in the first, second, and third grades across the United States. Why wouldn't you test this on adults if they're the ones that are more likely to die from it?
That's a fantastic question. Maybe because all the adults are like, I don't want that. Give it to my kids.
I don't trust that. Operation Warp Speed, that can't... It's going to put 5G in me.
Also, this is quite the trial. What phase of trial was this that they injected 1.8 million children?
1, 2, 3, all at once. So the trial was declared a success on April 12, 1955, and over the next 4 years, more than 450 million doses of the Salk vaccine were distributed. During that time, the incidence of paralytic polio in the United States fell from 18 cases per 100,000 population to fewer than 2 per 100,000. In the years 1961 through 63, approval was given to a new vaccine developed by Albert Sabin at the University of Cincinnati, no relation to Nick at the University of Alabama, but yeah, Cincinnati, Ohio. So the Sabin vaccine, using live but attenuated virus, could be given in drops through the mouth and therefore became known as the oral poliovirus vaccine, or OPV. Soon it became the predominant vaccine used in the United States and most other countries. Now, we should comment on the difference between live attenuated or weakened vaccines and killed vaccines to eradicate any confusion. Right, we will cover this again, I'm sure, on an upcoming podcast focusing on the history of vaccination. That is, if Dr. John ever wants to write one of these. The two are differentiated based upon how they are made. Live attenuated vaccines contain a living, although significantly weakened, version of a virus or bacteria. Measles, mumps, and chickenpox vaccines are a few examples that are made with live viruses today. The benefit of a live vaccine is that 1 to 2 doses often provides lifelong immunity. No boosters needed, baby. The downside is that because the viruses and other pathogens are naturally mutate or change, the virus within the vaccine could also potentially change, creating a stronger version of itself that in unique circumstances, for example, an individual with a weakened immune system, i.e. the immunocompromised, possibly due to an HIV infection or prior organ transplant in today's society, the immune system would have difficulty combating the viral exposure and conceivably could become infected with the virus. And more importantly, these vaccines also usually require refrigeration. An inactivated vaccine contains a killed version of the pathogen. They're more stable, meaning they don't need refrigeration, and safer, considering there aren't cautions for the immunocompromised populations that are associated with the attenuated viruses. The downside is that they don't cause as strong an immune response. Thus, the immunity they provide may not last as long, and hence you might need a booster vaccine down the road. There you go. Hashtag knowledge bomb.
Beautifully described.
Well, good. By the early 1970s, the annual incidence of polio in the United States had declined 1,000-fold from pre-vaccine levels to an average of 12 cases per year. That's a pretty impressive decrease. Oh, COVID. Too many fucktards in this country.
That's the medical term.
Do your own research, though. I should note there were some road bumps, speed bumps, some big ones. In fact, there was one instance in which a large batch of the Salk vaccine produced at one of several laboratories across the country was found to be contaminated. You have to remember, in the mid-1950s, no one had ever produced a vaccine in such large quantities, and with such rapid production, once its effectiveness was confirmed, it was discovered by Bernice E. Eady, a veteran scientist at the NIH who was responsible for checking new vaccine batches for safety, that a flaw in the manufacturing process resulted in live, non-weakened poliovirus being placed in the vaccine rather than the killed virus. That would be a problem.
That seems bad.
Yes. She discovered this after one of the test monkeys got polio after receiving the vaccine. That is the opposite of what you would want to occur.
Poor monkey.
Poor test monkey.
Halstead. Was it Halstead's monkey?
It's cocaine monkey. Yeah. It's the only way he could slow it down. But even with braces, once he gave him a dose of cocaine, that monkey ran like Forrest Gump and they just broke off. He was free.
Forrest Gump didn't have polio, right? He just had crooked bones or something.
Although it was around that time, I mean, it could have been polio. I'm not sure. We'll have to look that one up. Anyway, so a freeze on the distribution of the contaminated batch was not immediate. Despite Edie sounding the alarm, as the process was complicated by public demand and non-medical bureaucrats wanting to fulfill that demand. In all, about 165,000 doses of the contaminated vaccine were shipped, and a recall was not activated until reports of mysterious polio infections came weeks after patients had been vaccinated. These reports included the death of the grandson of Alton Ochsner, a professor of surgery at Tulane Medical School at the time, and the founder of the Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans. Yet another reason we deal with vaccine hesitancy today.
Yeah, that's not great.
Thanks, 1954. Yeah. Perhaps I shouldn't call our some of our population fucktards. There's just enough nebulous stuff that happens in medicine that could cause hesitancy in some. Anyway, eventually a recall righted the ship, but not without an abundance of collateral damage. Public trust had been severely broken, but fear of infection ultimately won out. So maybe if COVID was a little more severe.
They didn't have a siloed media news outlet.
Really think if COVID today. Caused bloody diarrhea, I'm almost positive people would get vaccinated. I feel like that kind of scares the shit out of people.
Or erectile dysfunction.
Which I heard it does.
Yeah, get vaccinated.
I mean, maybe I didn't hear that, but nonetheless, maybe I did. You'll never know. The progress of the vaccine was mirrored in other industrialized countries. Canada, having suffered its worst outbreak in 1953, almost 9,000 cases of all types of polio, quickly began production of the Salk and Sabin vaccines. And in 1965, only 3 cases of polio were reported. Finland began limited vaccination with the Salk vaccine in 1957. Following 2 major outbreaks in 54 and 56, and some 1.5 million persons were vaccinated in a mass campaign between 1960 and 61, which eliminated the disease altogether in that country. Belgium began using the Salk vaccine in 58 and the Sabin vaccine in 63. As a result, polio disappeared as an endemic disease in the late 1960s. Denmark introduced IPV to its population in 1955 and OPV in 1963. In OPP in 1997, and experienced only sporadic cases of the disease in 1962. I don't know, is that timing right?
Nice. I got it.
When did nature get naughty?
Yeah, slow clap.
Even as the introduction of vaccines led inexorably to the decline and eventual disappearance of polio in the developed countries of the temperate world, only some 5% of school children were being routinely immunized in the less developed countries of the tropics, where the disease was not considered to be a problem. However, when lameness surveys were conducted during the 1970s in several tropical countries, hopefully no one is conducting one of those today in association with our podcast. It's a terrible joke. I'm going to edit that out. It was
learned. That was great. That was a great joke. I was going to make a lameness joke.
It was learned to considerable surprise that 5 to 9 of every 1,000 school children had evidence of lameness due to paralytic polio. Oh, so it's not like they were lame. It's they were crippled.
That's not the correct nomenclature.
Due to paralytic polio, immunization against polio was included in the expanded program on immunization launched by the World Health Organization in 1974. And by 1989, the proportion of children being immunized rose to some 67%. In 1985, the Pan American Health Organization, WHO's regional body for the Americas, announced an initiative to eradicate indigenous transmission of polio from that part of the world by the end of 1990. That followed not only the success of the United States and Canada in eliminating the disease, but also successes in Brazil and Cuba, among other countries. Cuba began mass immunizations in 1962 and brought the number of cases down from 214 per year in the 1950s to a total of 5 cases between 1963 and 78. Brazil began an immunization campaign in 1980 and reported cases there dropped from an average of 2,300 per year in the late 1970s to 69 cases in 1982. And in 1994, all of the Western Hemisphere was declared free of indigenous polio.
That's insane. That is such a remarkable thing. I know we get to more remarkable things, but what a campaign.
When people buy in to science, when the science is sound and the medicine is there, I mean, this stuff works. But so progress in the Americas was a major factor in the decision by WHO's World Health Assembly in 1988 to call for the eradication of polio from the globe by the year 2000. One of those, if they can do it, anyone can, unquote, backhanded compliments. The Global Polio Eradication Initiative was joined by UNICEF, Rotary International, and other organizations. And by 2000, the number of new cases of paralytic polio had been reduced from more than 250,000 per year to approximately 1 to 2,000. Complete elimination of the disease by the target year was not possible given the complexity of storing and distributing the vaccine, the distribution of record keeping, or the disruption of record keeping in countries plagued by poverty and conflict and suspicion of resistance on the part of some local leaders. But nevertheless, polio as an endemic disease had been limited to regions within the countries of Nigeria, India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan alone. Travelers from polio endemic countries frequently exported cases to other countries. For example, a polio outbreak that emerged in April 2010 in Tajikistan was caused by a strain of poliovirus 1 that was very closely related to a strain isolated in Uttar Pradesh, India. Later that year, the virus appeared in Kunduz province in northeastern Afghanistan, which shared a border with Tajikistan. Both Tajikistan and Kunduz province had been polio-free for more than a decade prior to the 2010 outbreaks. A sudden surge in polio cases and deaths in late October and early November 2010 in the Congo raised further concern that poliovirus was spreading from polio-endemic regions. The outbreak in the Congo was believed to have been caused by wild poliovirus 1 from India. And in August in 2011, PV1 was also isolated from 4 children in China. The additional cases were reported the following month. The virus, which had not been reported in China since 1999, was similar genetically to poliovirus circulating in Pakistan, which had experienced an increase in PV1 viruses in 2011. So that same year, the WHO also recorded a roughly fourfold increase in polio cases in Nigeria from 11 the previous year to more than 40, raising concerns that the disease might spread rapidly to high-risk countries, a fear that was confirmed with 2 outbreaks in Somalia shortly thereafter. A subsequent intense vaccination campaign in Africa, however, led to the apparent elimination of the disease from the region. No cases have been detected for more than a year, last noted in from 2014 to 2015. Today, polio remains endemic in 2 countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And another trivia nugget for you, the most famous affected American was, do you know it? Do you know it? Do you know it, Dr. John?
I don't want to cheat, but yes. FDR, baby.
Yeah, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who got polio and was paralyzed from the waist down in 1921 when he was 39.
I thought that he had childhood polio. I did not know that he got it as an adult.
Well, statistically, if you looked at the likelihood of him contracting paralytic polio,
yeah,
it would most likely be in adulthood.
Man, that would suck.
Yeah, you know, I wonder, after kind of our evacuation of Afghanistan, if we... Like, I'm sure doctors or wherever the Afghan refugees were coming into were probably immunizing people for polio. I mean, I assume that occurred.
Part of the, yeah.
It would be something, though, that I probably would not have thought about had I not researched this this topic. I would have been like, oh, welcome to America.
Yeah. Bundle of vaccines. Here you go.
Yeah.
You have to get vaccinated. The other people, that are born here, we let make those decisions for themselves, do their own research. Another super interesting episode.
I think this was a good episode. Because to be honest, I feel like as a medical professional, you're very aware of polio, and you have it. I mean, I won't speak for everyone, a limited understanding of the disease and its history and its course throughout the world. But because it has been eradicated from, you know, essentially the United States, it's kind of, it's not an everyday concern or really a yearly or monthly concern for that matter. I thought it was very interesting to do some research on this and just kind of learn about the history and the progress that we made as a society once we encouraged everyone to get vaccinated.
Like, as an internist, I don't know if I would have polio on my differential for somebody coming in with like lower extremity weakness. I wonder.
Pakistan, Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Recent travel.
Like, I wonder how it shows up in the CSF. Interesting. Well, thanks again, Dr. Guy.
Well, man, Dr. John, thanks for joining. Even though you're on vacation in Key West.
Hey, man, it never stops here. Never stops here at Disease, Death, and Doctors.
No, I mean, and I'm glad that you volunteered to wear your DDD Speedo tomorrow. Your wife will surely approve.
Yeah.
As will the Key West locals.
Got to get all that free advertising that we can.
That's right. Yeah. But thank you, listeners, for tuning in once again.
Smash that subscribe button.
Like us, subscribe, all that stuff.
Tweet us.
Tune in 2 weeks for another rousing, rousing episode of Disease, Death, and Doctors.
Cheers.
Stay safe. Toodles.